Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. America today is facing the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression. We have hundreds of thousands of people who have lost their homes. Some of the country's biggest investment firms have declared bankruptcy. Some people have predicted global recession. This morning, we'll try to talk a little bit about the response to this current crisis and also perhaps try to put it in perspective as we look back to some of the major economic disasters of the last 150 years or so. Our guest for the program is Robert Barrow. He is professor of economics at Harvard University. He's also senior fellow at the Hoover Institution of Stanford and a research associate of the National Bureau of Economic Research. He will be the keynote speaker at this year's Northern Trust Forum. This is an event that is sponsored by the Klein Center for Democracy on the U of I campus and will be taking place on November 13th and 14th. This is something that's happening at the new iHotel Chancellor Ballroom here in Champaign-Urbana, and I believe that it's open to anybody who is interested in attending. You can certainly go on the web and find more information about it that way. Here this morning as we talk with our guest, questions are certainly welcome. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, is 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, so if it would be a long-distance call, use that one. That's 800-222-9455. Anyone's certainly welcome to call with questions, comments. The only thing we ask callers is that people are brief, so we can keep moving, get in as many callers as possible. But certainly, callers are welcome. Again, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Professor Barrow, hello.
Yes, hello.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Of course.
You know, one thing that I guess I was struck by in all of the coverage of and everything that's been said so far about where we are was some of the things that Alan Greenspan said when he was testifying before Congress. And he said essentially what I understood him to be saying is that maybe everything he thought he knew about the economy and how it operated, he was now questioning. That may be a little bit overly dramatic, but essentially that's what I heard him say. Here, for example, I have a story here in front of me from the Washington Post, and there's an exchange between Mr. Greenspan and Congressman Waxman from California. He said, Mr. Waxman said, you found that your view of the world, your ideology was not right, it was not working. And Mr. Greenspan said, absolutely, precisely. You know, that's precisely the reason I was shocked, because I've been going for 40 years or more with very considerable evidence that it was working exceptionally well. And it goes on from there. So I guess that made me wonder, well, are we at a point here where some long, strongly held assumptions about the economy and how it works are up for grabs?
You know, I think it's still true that the prosperity of the United States and the other developed countries comes mainly from free markets and free enterprise. And that view, which I think Greenspan had embraced, hasn't really changed. It is true that there are situations in terms of financial crises where the markets don't work so well and some kinds of intervention maybe can be helpful. And that was certainly true during the Great Depression of the 1930s, which is the thing we're really worried about now. But it doesn't change the basic way that economies work and what it is that promotes prosperity. But in terms of predicting what will happen, I think we're going to see a lot more socialism. We're going to see that in various dimensions. And most of it is going to be negative, I think, for the economy.
Well, tell me a little bit more about that. So the proposal now of the government to be heavily involved in some big financial firms, initially the plan was to buy up bad loans, and now what's happened is the government has put money into very large banks, and this was the, as people remember how this was covered, this was apparently the proverbial offer that could not be refused
right. From
the Secretary of the Treasury. He rounded up all these guys who were heads of these big financial institutions and said, you're going to take this much, and you're going to take this much, and we're going to buy ownership position. We will, in exchange, take ownership positions in your institutions, and that was that. Do you think that was the appropriate way to go?
I think there can be a rationale for providing more capital to the key financial players in the economy, and it's clearly much more effective to do that through the method you just described, which is providing some kind of equity rather than buying up the assets, because buying up the assets requires you really to value all these kinds of individual loans. And the difficulty in doing that is part of the crisis itself, and it's not that the government or some of its agencies is particularly adept at that either. So I think they're operating on the right side now of the balance sheet, essentially. And I think there is some rationale for providing that kind of funding. And I think they made a mistake not doing it with Lehman Brothers. I think that was the key to this most recent phase of the financial crisis, which has made it so serious, particularly after, quote-unquote, bailing out Bear Stearns last spring. It was a mistake then not to go forward to essentially continue with something like that with the major players, including Lehman.
Well, that's I'm interested that you would say that, because that was one of the things that I was wondering about looking back here, is that it seemed from moment to moment the government was taking a different sort of position. At least initially, the government put, if you go back to mid-September, the government put money into Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. They backed, as you say, they backed the buyout of Bear Stearns by J.P. Morgan Chase. Then they said to Lehman Brothers and to Merrill Lynch, that were both in trouble at the time, nope, sorry, we can't do anything for you. Lehman went bankrupt. Merrill Lynch was bought by Bank of America. Then virtually as soon as Lehman Brothers went bankrupt, then the government said, but we will bail out AIG to the tune of some $85 billion. And then we went on to the $700 billion rescue package. That seems... is that just an indication of how difficult this was, and the fact that it seems like from one day to the next we weren't quite sure what we were doing?
It's unquestionably difficult, and people who pretend that they know exactly what happened and what to do about it are basically making it up. So to that extent, one can have sympathy for the government policymakers. But I think they wanted to pretend that having set up the system in response to the Bear Stearns business in terms of some of the facilities that were created, they wanted to pretend like they'd fixed the problem, and then they could just let the system operate without further intervention beyond that. And that was where I think they made the mistake with Lehman. I mean, Lehman was not really different from Bear Stearns. In fact, I think they were probably in better shape. So I think they made a really bad calculation there, and that particularly impacted on some of the money market operations and such. I don't know if that was some personal thing with respect to Paulson and Fold at Lehman or what. I think it was a serious error, and you know, Paulson has been trying to excuse it now by saying he didn't have the authority to do something with Lehman, but you know, obviously the government has not worried about that in any of these other cases, so that doesn't really make any sense.
Well, how do you overall assess so far how Mr. Paulson's done in dealing with this crisis?
Well, that was one key decision, which I think led to a lot of trouble, so you know, he's a very much a sort of hands-on CEO-type person. He has a lot of confidence. I don't think it's really based on a lot of knowledge, because it is a very difficult problem. So given the magnitude of that error, I don't think you can say that he's doing very well.
I think that there were a lot of people who, when this bailout package was up for discussion, and particularly I'm thinking that a lot of these people were Republicans in the Congress, who said this is a violation of what has always been our basic orientation, at least what we said was our orientation, which was hands-off, essentially, and that we shouldn't do this because we're betraying what is an important principle, that the government's not going to be directly involved in the economy in this way. And it may be that some people would say that it was necessary and there was no choice. But I guess I'm wondering what you think about the consequences and whether, in fact, you think this is a serious kind of departure from what you would advocate should be the way that the government approaches managing the economy, which is, you know, the managing least is managing best.
Well, again, going back to my opening remarks, I mean, I think that there's an important basis for free market type policies, which usually means the government should not be intervening. But my studies have also certainly convinced me that these major kinds of economic crises, financial crises, of which the Great Depression is the main one for the United States, those are really overriding. They're more important than almost everything else. And often it's true that the financial markets don't operate so well in those circumstances. And then there is a basis for thinking that the situation might be improved by having the government intervene in certain ways. So I think, indeed, there is a case, and I always thought that was true in the context of the Great Depression, despite my free market orientation, for intervention in this kind of extreme financial crisis. But it is also true that this is going to be the basis for the government intervening in all kinds of things, most of which will be a mistake. And that also was true from the 1930s, because that promoted a tremendous amount of government intervention in the economy in terms of New Deal policies and policies that were really run at least through the 1960s, 1970s, which was too much government activism. So it came out of a legitimate case of trying to do something for the Depression. But then it worked out into a long history of too much of the government involvement. And that's probably going to be true in the present case, not only in the U.S., but worldwide, I imagine.
So what I wonder if there's anything specific that you have in mind. Is this, for example, are we thinking about or talking about demands from other kinds of industries other than the banking industry for government assistance, like, let's say, the auto industry, for example?
Absolutely. So, you know, the auto industry is sort of next in line, but I think there's going to be a tremendous amount of demand for government subsidy of various industries. Also government subsidy of individual homeowners who probably never should have been borrowing to buy homes in terms of people who didn't really have the credit. There's going to be a tremendous pressure to essentially use taxpayer money to transfer it to people who are partly responsible for the problem. But I don't put most of the weight, though, on the individual borrowers. I think the way the financial system operated is much more important as to why was it that that system was allocating so much in the way of funding to people who didn't really have the collateral, didn't really have the credit.
Well, and would, as some people suggest, that is this a failure of government oversight?
Well, I think there are various things that came together. I mean, one of it was pressure to be lending more toward low-income persons who typically didn't have sufficient income and sufficient collateral to justify usual residential mortgages. So a lot of that was coming through the Congress. Part of it was operating through Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and part of it was more broad in terms of pushing for more lending at less than the usual kind of valid terms. It's ironic that some of the same people in Congress who were pushing for this are now pretty high up in terms of trying to correct the system. Some of the same people really are involved. But in general, it was true that there was too much in the way of a supply of mortgage funding, particularly at very favorable terms in terms of low down payments, not too much requirements in terms of income and credit history. And also interest rates were very favorable, and part of that had to do with the Fed's monetary policy. You know, it's also true that it was easy to originate loans like this and sell them off, which has to do with another part of the market in terms of a lot of the investment banks and others were willing to hold packaged mortgage securities. And I think this was partly just an error. I think it really is true that these companies thought that these were low-risk instruments. They really thought that a lot of these mortgage-backed securities, most of which were rated AAA, were low-risk. And that, I think, was just a mistake, which that particular mistake won't be repeated. I think the main mistake there was to think that because you diversified over a lot of individual loans, that somehow the overall package was not very risky, but that ignored the fact that there was a common risk to most of these loans, particularly having to do with housing prices and with the overall macro economy.
Well, there I guess I would think that is where a lot of people would like to place the blame. They would say that here we had some very large financial institutions that had constructed these investment instruments that were all based on an asset that everybody in their hearts knew was hugely overvalued, and what they thought that they were doing was somehow passing on the risk to someone else or insuring themselves against risk. And it turns out that it was all built on the proverbial shifting sand, and that truly everybody should have known it.
I don't know. It's sort of easy with hindsight. I mean, you not only needed a reduction in national housing prices, which we've been getting now, but you needed a pretty substantial one. It looked like the what was rated AAA, it looked like it required housing price reductions of something like 30% to get those assets to be in trouble, and people assumed ex ante that the probability with that of that was almost zero. With hindsight, you can see why maybe this should have been foreseen, but I don't think that I'm more clever than these institutions, and they've been suffering greatly. I mean, this is not about Wall Street greed, as McCain likes to say in particular. It's really that they didn't understand how risky these kinds of assets were in certain kinds of aggregate crisis situation, which is like the one we're having.
Mm. Well, and did they though think that they were insuring themselves against that risk, particularly, I guess, using the mechanism of the credit default swap? And they thought that, first of all, they thought that there was no downside, but then they said, well, okay, if there's a problem, we're covered. And that, in fact, they were deceiving themselves whether that would adequately take care of the problem if the bubble burst.
Well, some people were covered, but of course, others were on the other side of that, providing the insurance. And AIG is particularly in trouble, I think, because of that. So partly, as you say, it's that people were overestimating the extent to which they were covered if they were getting the insurance, because it might not be delivered in such an efficient way. But you know, the insurance itself has to aggregate out to zero, so somebody is also providing the insurance, and those are the people who are even more in trouble than the ones who were buying the insurance and thinking they were covered. But again, in terms of the providers of the insurance, they thought they were doing something that was a very low-risk activity. In particular, AIG thought that. Mm-hmm. And they couldn't imagine that so much of this stuff would be called at the same time. But that was neglecting this sort of systemic risk, which I mentioned earlier, underestimating that. And you know, these are very smart people. I don't feel comfortable judging them ex post that they were overestimating how safe this stuff was. It's easy to say now that it wasn't really safe. But it is true that this particular mistake won't be repeated, that people have learned this, although at great cost. But blaming these things on risk, blaming this sort of thing on greed is, I think, completely uninformative. It doesn't tell you what to do, and it's not that greed is any larger now than it used to be in history. So that's just totally misplaced. I think it's just irrelevant.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Robert Barrow. He is Paul Warburg Professor of Economics at Harvard University, Senior Fellow of the Hoover Institution, Research Associate of the National Bureau of Economic Research. He'll be here in Champaign-Urbana not too long from now, about 10 days, to take part in the 2008 Northern Trust Forum. This is sponsored by the Klein Center for Democracy on the U of I campus. This is taking place November 13th and 14th. He'll be giving the keynote talk, Macroeconomic Disaster Since 1870. And questions, comments are welcome. We have lines full. We will get two callers and take them in the order they came in, starting with Bloomington, Indiana, line 4. This is the toll-free line. Hello.
Hi, I have two questions. First question is about AAA-rated securities. If I understand this correctly, when banks borrow from each other, they use for security. They secure the loans with, as they call them, mortgage-backed security, these mortgage contracts. And the rating agencies were rating these securities. When one bank is lending money to another bank, and the other bank is using mortgage-backed securities for collateral, the only way that the loaning bank has to know that those securities are any good is how they're rated. And the rating agencies are rating them AAA. So, in other words, hey, this is good paper. You can loan money on the basis of this paper. And it turned out not to be good. Now, wasn't that basically dishonest? I'm thinking the rating agencies were being actually dishonest in rating paper AAA that they actually knew was not AAA. Is that right? And then I have another question.
I have no reason to think this is based on dishonesty. I mean, the whole concept here was you put together a whole bunch of mortgages, and then you had a few lower tranches, 10, 20%, maybe 30%, which was supposed to bear all the risk until that part was wiped out. So if you look at the stuff that was in the higher tranches above the lowest 20 or 30%, that was supposed to be affected by defaults on mortgages only when the fraction in the whole pool that was going bad exceeded 20% or 30%.
Yeah.
And that was thought to be extremely unlikely as an event, that you could get up to these higher tranches being affected by problems in the overall mortgage housing market. So that's why these upper tranches, which is really above the lowest 20 or 30%, were rated AAA, because this event was thought to be extremely unlikely.
So it wasn't until the loans started not to became unperforming loans that they knew that the AAA rating was wrong. In other words, they had to start defaulting before anybody knew.
But not only defaulting, but you need more than 20% or 30% of the whole pool to default to get any effect on the upper tranches. That was the idea.
Okay. My next question.
But, you know, I think it's true that we've gotten much too far away from where the loans are originated.
Yeah.
And then the people who are holding the paper, as you say, have no real direct way of evaluating the quality of the underlying loan and the underlying borrower. I think there's been too much separation between knowing about who's being loaned to, whose house it is, what their income is, what their collateral is, and who's holding the paper. There was a good reason to have this separation. The idea was to diversify the whole market, to diversify it nationally, even internationally, and to have many different groups and people holding the paper, rather than having it concentrated in the locality where, for example, the house was located, which was the traditional model of a local bank. So there was some good reason to move to this securitized model, but there's also problems with it, and the problems have turned out to be more serious than were imagined.
Second question. It seems to me that when Lehman Brothers failed, that failure set off the cascade of credit defaults. That made the credit default swap crisis become it materialized then, because from that time on they had all this credit default swap liability that was not backed. There was not a reserve of money to pay these credit default swaps, and once Lehman Brothers failed, the government let Lehman Brothers fail. All kinds of financial institutions had credit default swap liability, and suddenly, banks couldn't trust each other because of the liability that they knew that their counterparty banks were had all this liability. Would you explain what a credit default swap is? And then, if I've got this right, explain why once Lehman Brothers failed, the credit default swaps became such a crisis. And I'll take the answer on the air.
You know, I think you're right at pinpointing that incident. I mean, one part of that was that Lehman bonds were being held by a particularly large money market fund, and then everybody thought those bonds were going to be okay. Even if Lehman got into trouble and its stock went to zero, people thought that the bonds were going to be all right, particularly because people were relying on the government to do something akin to the Bear Stearns, quote-unquote, bailout. But when those bonds of Lehman were marked down, it really affected a money market fund, and then they could no longer maintain this one-to-one kind of price that we've been having on money markets. And that, I think, caused a lot of trouble with respect to financial institutions dealing with each other. So I think it did set off the most serious part of this crisis. I mean, the essence of a credit default swap is just that it's essentially an insurance against default on whatever asset is being considered, which could be a mortgage or some other kind of debt obligation. So it's essentially an insurance agreement, although the details of it are different from that. It's essentially insurance against default on the underlying a claim.
Well, I guess I'm interested in the point that the caller makes, where you think that at the point where the government said it wouldn't help Lehman, did other big firms, did this set off a kind of crisis of confidence because a lot of other big firms are saying now suddenly we're on our own, that no one is going to come and help us?
Well, AIG was the key. I mean, they were even more important for the financial system and more central in terms of their role in insuring a lot of the claims through credit default swaps and other things. So, but when all this trouble took place, the government decided it couldn't let AIG just go bankrupt. And that was when they sort of moved into the sky's the limit mode in terms of providing close to $100 billion for AIG in terms of immediate funding. So after the Lehman thing and the financial market reaction to that, then the government decided it couldn't let that kind of thing happen again, and then we had AIG, and then we had other things.
All right, let's go on to another caller here, Champagne, line one. Hello.
Yes. Am I on?
Yes.
Oh, yes. According to the would it be the case that financial innovation would always sort of work its way around regulations that were imposed for previous financial crisis, that new products had always managed to find their way around and still put, I think, the late Hyman Minsky has a theory to some extent. And secondly, can financial regulation by the government be put on a Federal Reserve basis, so it would be somewhat insulated from Congress and be more in accord with international bodies?
You know, I think there's some tendency for financial market players to work around regulation and come up with new products and new methods of operating. But that doesn't mean regulation is irrelevant. I think a regulation can have important effects. Some regulations can be positive, but I think more often they're going to end up having negative effects. The government also tends to regulate things that the financial markets have already figured out, because a lot of the underlying problems in the current situation were about overestimating how low risk some of these instruments were. And the financial market players have now figured that out. They're not going to make that mistake again, but now the government is going to come in and regulate something there which is actually unnecessary. It's not like these companies are happy about the situation or ended up doing well. They have a lot of incentive to avoid this kind of outcome. And I think now that they understand something about the underlying risk characteristics of these instruments, they're not going to repeat that mistake. So the government regulation there is not going to be too useful. You know, it would be terrific if you could set up a regulatory system that was more insulated from the political process, as you say, more like the central bank, the Federal Reserve, but I don't think that's what's going to come out. I think that Congress is in particular going to have more influence, and to see how ill those effects can be, you can look at the Fannie Mae, and Congress has continually pressured Fannie Mae over the years to be more liberal in its lending policies and to complain when they don't lend enough, in quotes. Barney Frank was particularly active in that over the years. It was pressure completely in the wrong direction, and that was well understood by economists for many years, that these mortgage agencies that were sort of pseudo-government entities were a real problem there.
We're a bit past our midpoint. I have some other callers. I want to thank the last caller, and again, to just very quickly introduce our guest, Robert Barrow. He is a professor of economics at Harvard University, senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, and research associate of the National Bureau of Economic Research. He will be the keynote speaker at the 2008 Northern Trust Forum. This is sponsored by the Klein Center for Democracy on the U of I campus. He'll be giving the keynote talk, Macroeconomic Disaster Since 1870. This will be on the 13th of November. Questions here this morning are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And I believe that our next caller is in Champaign, I think, line number two. Hello.
Champaign County.
Indeed. Oh, Champaign. Oh, okay, fine. Good. Yeah, go ahead.
Right. It seems to me that the Klein Center for Limited Democracy and Capitalism has taken over for the ill-fated Academy. because bringing in someone who doesn't know, for instance, that there was rating malfeasance, there's documentary evidence of emails of people inside some of the agencies saying, how are we getting away with this kind of thing? So there definitely was malfeasance, and to not know about it is sounds like some willful ignorance or something. Excuse me, but I had to say it. The whole concept of how close this economy has been to free market is one of the basic lies that's quite rampant. I mean, we've been military Keynesianists for quite a while. I mean, the offense department, as I like to call it, is full of pork, and I know that some right-wingers decry it from time to time, but they don't allow that it's actually just so distorting of any of their image of a free market that they should just give up and be consumer advocates or reform advocates, it seems to me, before they start peddling this free market stuff. Now, as far as calling credit default swaps insurance, as I've encountered some right-wing economists doing it, it is not insurance if it's not capitalized, as even the caller from Bloomington, Indiana pointed out. It is not insurance. It's a wager, and it should be treated as such. It may be made illegal, it seems to me. There's no underlying basis for anybody expecting those to be paid back, but it is sort of, as you pointed out, that it gave them confidence. I think I'm speaking more of the host. It gave confidence to these people that were buying these peculiar new instruments. As far as the government not being involved, of course, the Graham thing that was stuck in the middle of the night that allowed for Enron and is still allowing for the oil market to be run in a very non-transparent way, it was clearly advocated for in the political arena. And the free marketeers won, and Greenspan at least has the some kind of honesty to say that he's in a state of shock about it, whereas you're still in down-the-river denial. So that's not a question, but I'm sure you'll pick something out of that to respond to. Thank you.
All right. Well, a number of points. You can do that however you like.
Well, since I seem to be guilty of willful ignorance, I think perhaps I should be regulated more by the government, similar to some of these players in the financial markets. I don't understand the point about insurance as being a wager. Of course insurance is a wager. It's always been a wager. The issue here in this market is whether the issuers of insurance have enough collateral or capital to pay off in the case of a default when things go bad. That was the problem with AIG. It looked like they weren't going to have enough, and the government decided that was a serious problem, and that's why they dumped in $85 billion to AIG in terms of being willing to pay up here. I didn't understand the point about militant Keynesianism because I couldn't tell whether the caller was complaining about too much free market or too much Keynesianism, which I think is sort of the opposite of free market. If you want my views on the current administration in terms of the previous two terms, I think the best thing that the Bush administration did from an economic point of view was the tax cut of 2003, which was a very well-designed tax program that particularly encouraged investment, and I think it made the recession around 2001-2 much more mild than it would have been otherwise. But if you look aside from that, the Bush administration has been guilty of very much profligate spending. We've had a tremendous increase in government programs of various kinds. And in contrast, the previous Clinton administration was much more conservative and much more careful about not expanding the size of the federal government in terms of expenditure. Part of that was moving toward a surplus, but more in particular, the level of spending didn't rise nearly as rapidly under Clinton, who was nominally a Democrat, as compared to Bush, who is nominally a Republican. So the big disappointment about the Bush administration is that it really turned out to be very much of a big government type of entity.
All right. We'll go to another caller here, Effingham, line number 4. Hello.
Yes, two questions. first, if you will verify what I think I heard, that the capitalist, not understanding what was about to happen, and it did. Did you make that reference, sir?
The capitalist?
Well, the financial institutions and the very things we're talking about. I mean, they're all intertwined. They're all the same stamp. Capitalism in any form adheres to markets and what you're talking about. But I think I heard you say that they didn't understand what was about to happen of the current.
I think the main financial market players, such as the big investment banks, were assigning close to zero probability for a kind of outcome that was going to cause the value of a lot of their assets to fall as much as it did.
Why not?
And
why didn't they understand?
I don't think it was well understood that you could have this kind of a fall, in particular in national housing prices, and that would have the extent of the consequence that it had on the mortgages that were related to the housing.
Well, it seems incredible that the people who actually manipulate this system would not have understood that it was going to fall like it did in 29, and then like your book suggests that it goes back into the 19th century and actually goes back to the 18th century in these kinds of events, and then not to understand the very world that these people have created and have all the fallout that is going on, homelessness and starvation around the world, like it did in 29, I find that just hard to swallow.
You know, for the U.S., you really do have to go back to the Depression of the early 1930s to find anything that has this sort of comparable ingredients. It's not actually 1929 in the initial stock market decline, but it's actually what came after that. Particularly going up to 1931, that you had the extent of the decline and the real implosion of the credit markets in the United States in that period. But I agree with you if you're saying that you need to take more of a historical perspective and to look not just at the United States, but globally. And then you do find more in the way of examples of major financial crises and macroeconomic collapses that are often, but not always, related to that.
We just have about 10 minutes here, and I have some other callers. And I hope the caller will forgive me, because I do, now that we've touched on the Great Depression, I do want to give you a chance to put this into some kind of perspective. As that's what I understand you're going to be doing with this talk that you're going to give. For a lot of people, there is nothing else to compare this to except the Great Depression. And of course, a lot of people within living memory, there is no such. This is the worst thing that they've ever seen. Certainly, there were other financial panics in American history. Although, again, I guess nothing as bad as the Great Depression. Is this like that? Is it different from that? Are there any lessons that we draw from that?
We don't know yet how much it's going to be like the Great Depression. What's true overall is that if you look at the major macroeconomic collapses that have occurred, and we're not yet in that position today, I should say, for the United States in particular, most of the macroeconomic collapses that have occurred have also been associated with stock market crashes. However, there are many stock market crashes, financial market disasters that are not associated with major macro collapses. So most recently in the United States, you have a very major stock market decline in 2000-2002, a lot of that in the NASDAQ market, but also more broadly. And before that, the most serious stock market decline is 1973-74. There's also the 1987 decline, but it's not actually nearly as big in the United States if you look over a year or more as it is in some European countries. But in all of those cases, you had stock market crashes that were not associated with anything like depressions. You only had mild recessions in a couple of those cases. So if you look at the macroeconomic data today in the U.S., it looks at most like a mild recession. It'd probably be a recession starting in the third quarter, certainly the fourth quarter of this year. But that doesn't mean it's going to be a serious macroeconomic decline, and that's what we don't know yet. We don't know whether this is going to be a decline on the order of the early 1930s in the U.S., when the GDP declined by 29%, for example, between 29 and 1933, or whether more likely it'll be a mild recession, such as numbers that we've seen in the post-World War II period in the United States. And we don't know the answer to that yet. We know we have a major financial crisis, major stock market decline. We don't know how much that's going to show up in the gross domestic product or consumption or other variables.
All right, let's talk with someone in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Oh, hi, how are you? I would go to the Securities and Exchange Commission's chairman at a congressional hearing. Said he was asked about this, well, what is it? What's the problem? And he goes, I guess self-regulation doesn't work. That is a direct quote from him. But I wanted to ask you about, when you say people are surprised, I think what they're really surprised at is their computer models. Because I go back to LTCM, which I'm always talking about on this program whenever economists are on. Long-term capital management collapsed in 98, and it was based, the whole company was based on modeling human economic behavior, which is basically human behavior, an attempt to describe the activity of individuals within certain scenarios. And a lot of these models exist in banks and in, you know, brokerage homes, houses. And I'm wondering if the, when you say people are surprised, I think what they do is they look at their computer models. Because a good example of that is after 9/11, there were the Economist reported about people modeling human behavior as macroeconomically, also in what possible happenings. 9/11 was not conceived as a possibility when they, you know, colliding planes into buildings. And they asked individuals who ran these companies, which are offshore, a lot of them, they said they had to readjust their models. How much of this, if this is really a tragedy and a catastrophe, how much of this is due to computer modeling of markets, thusly, you know, like sell or buy orders and stuff like that, and how much is economics leaning on mathematics when mathematics it consistently fails in when it attempts to describe human behavior? Could you just discuss that? Thank you.
I guess if I were to pick out some systematic things that I thought were missed, I think there's a tendency to de-emphasize too much the chance of these rare disaster kind of events, things that are sometimes called 10 sigma events, things that are way out in the tails, apparently. But in fact, those events occur more frequently than the usual kinds of probability distributions admit. That was true in terms of the model that LTCM was using in 1998, and I think it has relevance today in terms of thinking about outcomes where you were going to get such bad results with respect to certain classes of securities and therefore for the value of stocks of certain corporations. So I think there's not enough weight put on that kind of event. And as a related matter, there's not enough weight put on events that occur together. That is something that looks systemic, something that works in the aggregate, so you don't protect yourself by diversifying in the usual manner. When there's a common disturbance affecting a lot of things together, even if you're holding a lot of different types of stuff, you still do badly. So I think it's those two things that were underestimated, in particular in the current crisis beforehand, and maybe that's true more generally. I wouldn't condemn mathematics overall, I suppose, but this is something specific of the models that I think didn't get enough weight.
About 5 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Again, our guest is Robert Barrow. He's professor of economics at Harvard University. He'll be here on the campus of the University of Illinois next week to give a talk talking about the economic crisis that we're facing right now. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have a couple callers here. We'll try to get them both. Paw is next, toll-free line, line four. Hello.
Yeah, appreciate it. I kind of disagree with you a little bit. I think this whole thing is kind of self-induced. I think most people knew going into the mortgage crisis before it started that they weren't worthy of the mortgage. I mean, when I had to put 20% down in every house I ever bought, you know, all of a sudden they freed it up to get the money. Somehow there's a little bit of greed in there, don't you think? And then the other thing was that, you know, the way this country is going, the spending habits we have, we not just in as far as adults, but the kidney, the X generation, it's gotten way out of hand. I mean, now how many people in your college, sir, have credit cards? And they're running around with them, and they just basically overspend them because they have no sense whatsoever of the penalty, and that's the problem. I mean, every college student, including my own, gets a credit card. And the next thing you know is they're in debt. So basically, I don't give out credit cards to anybody anymore. And if they do, I can tell them this is a responsibility. I mean, the whole thing comes down to, I think this whole country has gotten way out of whack with the money issue. And I actually think it's going to come down to maybe going back to the gold standard again. I, to be honest with you, it's we're in a world of hurt. I mean, we keep giving money, whether it be the government or just in a family unit. Everybody thinks money grows on trees, and it doesn't. Let me
have you respond to at least the basic point that some people would have argued that before now, the big problem, and it was all up and down the economy from big companies to individuals, is that we were just way too heavily leveraged. We had way too much debt, more than was good for us.
Well, the debt, you know, cancels out. The debt doesn't aggregate to anything because what somebody's borrowing, somebody else is holding. So the level of debt... It doesn't really actually make sense to think of that as a critical factor for anything. I think it is true, and it was known beforehand, that terms were too liberal on a whole set of mortgages. And some of that, as I mentioned, was propelled by Congress. And people understood that that was a problem and was likely to lead to some increase in default rates down the road. What was not understood and was not given a lot of weight was that this would aggregate to such a big crisis where so much stuff would go bad at the same time. That, I think, was not at all understood, and that part was not greed. That part was not really understanding the workings of the model and the financial markets. I don't know if it's greed. If somebody's offered a really favorable mortgage with a low rate and very little down payment and such, I don't know if it's greedy to take that offer up. I think that's human nature. I don't think it's anything special in this situation. The more interesting question is why people were being offered such favorable terms and such low interest rates. So I find that a more interesting question about the workings of the markets rather than the sort of demands of individual homeowners who are maybe ending up over their heads.
All right. Back for another caller. Champagne, line one. Hello.
Hello. Well, give you my remark and then see if you can respond to it. It seems to me that you've given us a thumbnail sketch of free market dogma in which the government is eternally doomed, government action is hopeless, and this has indicated the narrowness of the dogma you've described is indicated by your willingness to scapegoat the government and martyr Paulson, who's probably not an iota different from you in theory. And the fact of the matter is, your free market dogma is unequivocally biased in favor of the owners of capital. And by definition of political economy, the only way that consumers could ever be equal is through the government representation. So how do you respond to that? Thank you.
I don't know if it's fair to be saying that I'm just, a slave to free market dogma or some such. I was being sympathetic to the idea that the government needed to intervene to some extent and in some ways in response to this financial crisis. And I thought that the government infusion in terms of adding to the capital of some key financial market players was probably a good idea. And I was actually supportive of that. And when I was criticizing Paulson, it was because he didn't intervene enough. It was because he let Lehman go bankrupt. I thought that was a serious error. But that was not along the lines of free market ideology. That was actually in the opposite direction, that particularly given that you were playing this policy of intervening and keeping the main players from going bankrupt and keeping the system operating. So this is a question of, what is the optimal way to intervene, how much. I'm not really questioning the idea that this was a valid response in the context of this severe crisis.
We're down to the point, we have maybe about a minute or two left. Just if I could return to the earlier point we were talking about, or you were talking about, just how bad this is and how bad it's going to be. And as I heard you say, at this point, we don't know. At what point do you think we'll have a better idea about how this is going to play out? Would it be, say, by about the middle of next year, do you think that we would have a better sense of where things are going?
Oh, definitely. Next year you'll have a lot more information. But I was trying to say, in terms of the history of events, there are a lot of major stock market crashes which do not end up in terms of macroeconomic depressions. And I say the most recent example in the U.S. of that is 2000-2002, where the real stock market value declined by almost 50%, but we had only a mild recession, 2001-2002. And something similar was true in 1973-74 in the United States and some other countries. On the other hand, if you look at where are the major depressions, such as the U.S. from 1929 to 33, it is true that that was accompanied with a major stock market crash. And if you find the major depressions throughout history, it is true that most of them have stock market crashes associated. So it's kind of like a stock market crash is almost a necessary condition for having a major macro depression, but it's not a sufficient condition. So that's why seeing the stock market implosion and related kind of financial market implosion, I'm worried, and I think that the chance of a depression type event is much higher than normal, but it's by no means for sure that we're going to have such a major collapse in terms of the macro economy. It could be that we'll just have a mild recession. That's still a possibility.
Well, there we're going to have to finish our guest for this part of Focus 580, Robert Barrow. He's professor of economics at Harvard University. He'll be giving the keynote lecture, Macroeconomic Disaster Since 1870. This is part of this year's Northern Trust Forum, sponsored by the Klein Center for Democracy on the U of I campus. That's taking place next week, the 13th and 14th. And Professor Barrow, thanks very much.
Thank you.